The Tolkien Road, Episode 239, The Return of the Shadow. Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 239. Greta, what's up?
Hey. What's up? We got sunshine.
Yeah, we do.
Which is nice after the last 2 days of rain and storms. So, feeling pretty good.
Yeah.
How about you?
I'm liking the sunshine as well.
Good. I know you don't mind the rain. I think I mind the rain more than you do, but...
Yeah, I like me a rainy day every now and then, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, not constant rain or anything.
No,
but
constant rain, but... Yeah, I like a little bit, but it's been a little too much for me lately, so I'm really happy we got some sun.
Yeah, well...
Yeah, and I'm also happy that... We're continuing with our History of Middle-earth series.
As you should be.
I am.
Mm.
I am.
Good.
Yes.
Well, vitamin D is always a good thing, and the History of Middle-earth is always a good thing as well. So like Greta said, on this episode, we are continuing our journey through the History of Middle-earth as we survey Volume 6, this bad boy right here, The Return of the Shadow, which is the first of four volumes dealing with the textual history of the Lord of the Rings.
So that's why it looks different than the other ones?
It looks different because I haven't yet bought them all as one thing, right? I've got different versions. Like the first five actually came as a set and like a mass market paperback or whatever
mm-hmm.
set.
Mm-hmm.
And then I bought the History of the Lord of the Rings for, which we'll get into all that. But anyway, I'd really like to at some point get all 12 volumes, actually really 13 because the index is included in that, in one set so that they all look really good on a bookshelf next to each other. But anyway, but before we get into any of that, we'd like to give a shout out to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Lise Yu, Andrew T, John R, and Ms. Anonymous.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, amazing executive producers.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd like to give a shout out to our newest patron as well, Julia.
Hey, Julia.
Julia, thank you for becoming a patron.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Very much.
You too can become a patron of The Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks like audio recordings of my two books, Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture. Check it out now to learn more about all the exciting perks we offer. And don't forget, you can now make an annual pledge and get 1 month free.
Good deal.
I think it's a pretty good deal myself.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Leave us a five-star rating. Leaving us a five-star rating and review helps get the word out about us. And we've also got our YouTube channel where some of you may be watching right now because we are releasing our episodes as videos now on YouTube. So you can go over there and instead of just listening to us and having the audio component, you can watch us as well. And you will know what I held up when I said this bad boy. So as well as just any other little, you know, seeing our smiling faces and
mm-hmm.
who knows, maybe we'll start to incorporate more visual aids in the future.
Okay.
So
that could be fun.
Got to see y'all subscribing and watching over there on YouTube though, you know, to give us the energy and the will to want to do that. So, you know, our next milestone is getting to 1,000 subscribers on YouTube. So, help us get there, right? You know, head on over there. You know, sometimes I will say this about YouTube. I listen to a lot of podcasts and I typically consume most of my regular content in audio format, but I'm more and more doing YouTube and I really like doing YouTube. And because, I mean, you can still get the audio, but sometimes it's nice just to be able to glance over and see who's talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's visual aids and there's like a lot of stuff on YouTube, including more stuff from the Tolkien Road that you don't necessarily just get in the podcast feed. So I highly recommend you just go over there and subscribe to us and, you know, give it a shot watching the show over there. So,
yeah. Sometimes it's nice to put a face with the voice.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree wholeheartedly, Greta. That was a fantastic point.
Thanks.
Yes.
I feel like it's funny sometimes, you know, when you just get so used to listening to someone and then you kind of create in your mind
mm-hmm.
like an idea of what they look like based on their voice alone.
Right.
And it's funny sometimes when you actually, you know, get to see a picture of them or something, and sometimes it lines up with what was in your head and sometimes it's totally different.
Yeah.
So anyway,
Very true words. Very true words. I agree.
Random thought.
No,
but
good point.
But this way you could, you know, if you've been listening to us and you have those ideas in your head of what we look like, you could go to YouTube and see how accurate your imagination was.
Leave a comment in the first video you see of us and just tell us if we looked like what you thought we'd look like or not. You don't have, you know, you don't have to necessarily be insulting, but whatever, you know.
We may have opened a can of worms there.
Boy, sorry. John's a lot stranger looking than I expected. How did John wind up with Greta? Man,
come on. That's probably going to be the most common response.
True.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, moving on. Whatever. It's starting to get awkward for people. All right.
Yes.
All right, Greta. You ready to explore the Return of the Shadow?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I'm a little scared by the size of the book, I'll be honest.
Well, you know we are not going through every single page.
I know. It's true. Okay.
For those of you who've forgotten or are just now joining us for this jaunt through Tolkiendom, we are in the midst of a journey through the History of Middle-Earth book series, which is a textual history of Tolkien's legendarium, depicted in roughly chronological order. While the last several episodes focused on Tolkien's earliest writings, which mainly concerned the first and second ages of Middle-earth, with this episode we begin an arc that will take us through the four volumes that focus on the composition of The Lord of the Rings, which took place from late 1937 through the early 1950s. We'll start with a survey of Volume 6, The Return of the Shadow. All right, so I want to quote, there's a good quote here at the very beginning. And it's from a letter Tolkien wrote in 1953 to W.H. Auden, who's, you know, a fairly well-known literary figure from that period, from the 20th century. And I thought it was a fitting little front thought for, you know, for this volume, because Tolkien did spend so much time on The Lord of the Rings, and we're so familiar with it in its finished version. But we have to understand that it was something that Tolkien was kind of discovering as he went along, right? As any creative person will tell you, I think. But it's interesting because I think Tolkien had just brought his own personality to it. So let me read this quote. All right. I met a lot of things on the way that astonished me. Tom Bombadil I knew already, but I had never been to Bree. Strider sitting in the corner at the inn was a shock, and I had no more idea who he was than had Frodo. The Mines of Moria had been a mere name, and of Lothlorien no word had reached my mortal ears till I came there. Far away I knew there were the horse lords on the confines of an ancient kingdom of men, but Fangorn Forest was an unforeseen adventure. I had never heard of the House of Eorl, nor of the Stewards of Gondor. Most disquieting of all, Saruman had never been revealed to me, and I was as mystified as Frodo at Gandalf's failure to appear on September 22nd. So
that's cool.
Yeah, I love that quote because you can hear within it that what I was describing before, that Tolkien was in a process of discovering so many things as he went along.
Mm-hmm.
As we'll find, and as we've talked about on past episodes, The Lord of the Rings came out of basically the publisher of The Hobbit asking him to write a sequel to The Hobbit, right? And he was like, it was kind of a standalone thing. I never really expect, you know, he never planned to make the Hobbit an ongoing thing, I guess you could say, right?
Right.
Before it was published, it was never this major conception of his that he was going to create a universe around, or a series of stories around this character of the Hobbit. It was very much fashioned as kind of a children's tale, right? And he was in the habit of creating stories for his children that were separate from his legendarium that we now know as Middle Earth, right? Hobbits had no place in the legendarium he had created before. I think I've highlighted, we'll actually see a little bit more of that. Christopher will talk a little bit more of that here. I think it's in the preface. I have it marked here, so we'll come back to that. But there's a really interesting passage that Christopher talks about where with The Hobbit, even though there are some figures that that made from the Legendarium that had made their way into The Hobbit. It was in a very passing way and almost not in a deliberate way. And it was almost just like Tolkien had these names on hand and he was like, well, I'll go ahead and use this name, right?
Hmm.
You know, for placeholders there. So,
yeah.
Anyway, Tolkien, as he was going along writing this new story about a hobbit or hobbits, did not really know where he was going from the beginning,
hmm.
right?
Yeah, I kind of love that. It's like he was discovering the story as he was writing it,
mm-hmm.
that there weren't these preconceived notions of, oh, it has to play out this way or this has to happen or whatever, it was literally, seems like it was a stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
And he was almost like, it was almost like he was being a reader and writer at the same time,
because
mm-hmm. he didn't know what was next.
You know, and it strikes me that so often these days, like, you know, you think of like a screenwriter, or, you know, somebody who develops a film will often sit down and they'll have a treatment for a story, right? And mm-hmm. that treatment will be kind of just a few paragraphs of kind of the summary of the plot of the story from start to finish, right? And I mean, a lot of the movies nowadays, that's like the movies that are blockbusters in the theaters, that's how they begin, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's somebody's treatment for a, you know, for this film, and then you take the treatment and then a screenwriter, maybe the same person, maybe another person, will turn it into the actual script for the film, right? The screenplay for the film. And so from the beginning, there's a sense before the actual writing of the thing that will become the film takes place, there's already a sense of where the story is going, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of what's
right.
involved.
Right.
But with Tolkien, he did not say, you know, I'm going to craft a story about Bilbo's nephew and his journey to destroy the ring that Bilbo found, because it's really the secret weapon of, you know, the necromancer, right? Which was necromancers mentioned in passing in The Hobbit. That never happened, right? Tolkien sat down and he basically just set out from Hobbiton again, right? Like he had in The Hobbit,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was on a journey of discovery all his own.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's an interesting thought, interesting idea from the outset to have in mind. All right. So this volume begins with a foreword that's a few pages long, and it's Christopher's foreword, obviously. This continues to be Christopher's project of compiling his father's notes. And so he explains a little bit about where he's coming from and what he had to deal with in putting this together. The first thing we learn is that Tolkien sold the Lord of the Rings manuscripts to Marquette University in 1957. Marquette's university in, I believe, in Illinois, near Chicago, if not in Chicago. But the elder Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, didn't do a great job of getting them all there. And the reason was they were in significant disarray. Shock of shocks.
I was going to say, right? That doesn't surprise me.
So, so I guess Tolkien was like, sure, I'll sell you my man. I'll sell you all my papers for Lord of the Rings. And then, you know, as we kind of picture with Tolkien, he had more, you know, that was actually a bigger task than he probably realized. So he had some stuff that I guess Christopher had to eventually find, and send, or Tolkien himself later found and sent along on a way. And then Christopher actually found some later. So Christopher wants us to know that the history of the Lord of the Rings was a very messy process to put together. Another thing we learned from the foreword is that writing of the Lord of the Rings proceeded in what Christopher calls waves. So this is a quote from Christopher here. So can you read from here to here, Greta?
Sure. The attempt to give an account of the first stages in the writing of the Lord of the Rings has been beset by other difficulties than the fact of the manuscripts being widely sundered. Difficulties primarily in the interpretation of the sequence of writing, but also in the presentation of the results in a printed book. Briefly, the writing proceeded in a series of waves, or, as I have called them in this book, phases. The first chapter was itself reconstituted three times before the hobbits ever left Hobbiton, but the story then went all the way to Rivendell before the impulse failed. My father then started again from the beginning, the second phase, and then again, the third phase. And as new narrative elements and new names and relations among the characters appeared, they were written into previous drafts at different times. Parts of a text were taken out and used elsewhere.
Yeah. So,
sounds very Tolkien-ish.
It proceeded in waves. Tolkien literally rewrote the first chapter several times before he even got past it, right? And we're going to see that there's some funny things about the original versions, right, of the story. So, you know, yes, this History of Middle-earth series is a little bit for the hardcore Tolkien fans, and it can seem like that. But since we're dealing with the Lord of the Rings here especially, it may be a little bit more accessible for, you know, for people who, you know, have been like, whoa, like it just makes your head spin, the first five volumes of this thing, right? Because you're already dealing with stories of the Silmarillion in those cases, which are difficult enough for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to deal with, like, where did those come from? You know, like the textual history of those things, right?
Right.
And now, but with Lord of the Rings, there's something a little bit recognizable about it, right? So, or a little bit more recognizable. And it's got hobbits in it, so that automatically makes it a little bit friendlier, right?
Right? Yeah, totally.
A little bit more, you know, down to the level of most of us.
We have more of a framework kind of in place to understand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
One thing we learned from the foreword is that, and we've talked about, I think, on past episodes, is that The Return of the Shadow, the name of this volume, was actually Tolkien's original proposal for what to title Volume 1 of The Lord of the Rings. So what we now know as Fellowship,
right.
Tolkien
yeah.
originally proposed calling The Return of the Shadow. So that's where the name comes from, which, you know, I think is cool. I like that name, honestly. I mean, Fellowship is Fellowship, right? That name will always be the name we hold near and dear in our hearts, but... yeah, I don't know. Like The Return of the Shadow has a very cool ring to it as well. So
yeah, it does. It does. It's definitely more ominous.
Yes.
Than The Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Anyway, just a little side note on that. So I mentioned The Hobbit earlier and the role that it plays in all of this. The Hobbit. Let me just read this passage because I think this is pretty interesting. The magic ring was the one obvious thing in The Hobbit that could be connected with the mythology. To be the burden of a large story, it had to be of supreme importance. I then linked it with the originally... J.R.R. Tolkien speaking. I then linked it with the originally quite casual reference to the necromancer, whose function was hardly more than to provide a reason for Gandalf going away and leaving Bilbo and the dwarves to fend for themselves, which was necessary for the tale. From The Hobbit are also derived the matter of the dwarves, Durin, their prime ancestor, and Moria, and Elrond. The passage in Chapter 3 relating him to the half-elven of the mythology was a fortunate accident, due to the difficulty of constantly inventing good names for new characters. I gave him the name Elrond casually, but as this came from the mythology, Elros and Elrond, the two sons of Irendel, I made him half-elven. Only in Lord of the Rings, was he identified with the son of Yarendel, and so the great-grandson of Luthien and Beren, a great power and a ring holder. So so we have all these like kind of little happy accidents and maybe these corners that Tolkien cut, and he gave himself just enough room to expand on some things that would allow him to really connect Lord of the Rings to the greater legendarium that he had created, right? So, it's interesting to see that, you know, with as little as The Hobbit did initially get connected with the legendarium, there was enough there for him to expand on it and do it much more.
Mm-hmm.
So,
interesting.
Yeah, I think that's pretty interesting myself. Yeah. So, what we've learned is that The Return of the Shadow mainly concerns the textual history of the beginning of The Lord of the Rings up to the stay in Rivendell. What we know is Book 1 and the first three chapters of Book 2. However, there are also three chapters included at the end that concern the journey from Rivendell to the Mines of Moria. All right, so quick overview of the table of contents. This book is divided into four parts. as Christopher said in that note about waves, he actually calls the waves phases in here. The first phase of this book includes 13 chapters. The second phase includes 5 chapters. The third phase includes 4 chapters. And then the story continued, which is the fourth part, includes 3 chapters. And those are the chapters that go beyond Rivendell. There's also an index as well as 7 illustrations included. Just to give you an idea of the illustrations. So they are the original opening page of The Lord of the Rings. So the very first time Tolkien set pen down to paper to write The Lord of the Rings before he knew it was called Lord of the Rings. We have that. Hmm. You can see a picture of it in here. The original description of the writing on the ring is also an illustration. The ring verse and the emergence of the ruling ring in the narrative. The plan of Bree. The emergence of Treebeard. The earliest map of the land south of the map of Wilderland in The Hobbit. So you can think Tolkien had his map, right, from The Hobbit, and he extends that south, right? The map of Wilderland, he extends that south in this volume. And then the inscription of the West Gate of Moria, right? So those are our illustrations in this chapter. I want to just real quick, I'm going to jump ahead just a bit. It's really interesting because if you recall, Greta, do you recall where Treebeard first shows up in Lord of the Rings?
It's in the second book, right?
What do you mean the second book?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's in the, I'm sorry.
You're talking about Two Towers?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
And Twin Towers,
sorry, I
didn't
mean
Towers.
To stump you.
No, that's okay. I literally couldn't remember the name of the second book.
Yeah. So you're right. Treebeard doesn't show up until the early part of the Two Towers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is way beyond where this ends. What's interesting is that he shows up in kind of early on in the phase of writing Lord of the Rings. Well before Tolkien had gotten there. So this is quoting from the section on Treebeard here. Something must be said here, and this is Christopher writing, something must be said here of giant Treebeard, for he emerged into a scrap of actual narrative at this time and had been mentioned by Gandalf to Frodo in Rivendell. I was caught in Fangorn and spent many weary days as a prisoner of the giant Treebeard. There exists a single sheet of manuscript which began as a letter dated July 27th through 29th, 1939, but which my father covered on both sides with fine ornamental script. One side of the sheet is reproduced opposite. Among the writings on the page are the words July Summer Diversions and lines from Chaucer's Reeve's Tale. For these diversions were a series of public entertainments held at Oxford in the course of which my father, attired as Chaucer, recited that tale. But the page is chiefly taken up with the text on which he afterwards penciled Treebeard.
Hmm.
And this is what he wrote of Treebeard. When Frodo heard the voice, he looked up, but he could see nothing through the thick and tangled branches. Suddenly he felt a quiver in the gnarled tree trunk against which he was leaning, and before he could spring away, he was pushed or kicked forward onto his knees. Picking himself up, he looked at the tree, and even as he looked, it took a stride towards him. He scrambled out of the way, and a deep rumbling chuckle came down out of the treetop. "Where are you, little beetle?" said the voice. "If you don't let me know where you are, you can't blame me for treading on you. And please, don't tickle my leg." "I can't see any leg," said Frodo. "And where are you?" "You must be blind," said the voice. "I am here." "Who are you?" "I am Treebeard," the voice answered. "If you haven't heard of me before, you ought to have done. And anyway, you are in my garden." "I can't see any garden," said Frodo. "Do you know what a garden looks like?" "I have one of my own. There are flowers and plants in it, and a fence round it, but there is nothing of the kind here." "Oh yes, there is. Only you have walked through the fence without noticing it, and you can't see the plants because you are down underneath them by their roots." It was only then, when Frodo looked closer, that he saw what he had taken for smooth tree stems were the stalks of gigantic flowers, and what he had thought was the stem of a monstrous oak tree was really a thick, gnarled leg with a root-like foot and many branching toes.
Hmm.
And so Christopher says, this is the first image of Treebeard, seeming in its air to come rather from the old Hobbit than the new. 6 lines in Elvish Tingvar are also written here, which transliterated read, "Fragment from The Lord of the Rings, sequel to The Hobbit. Frodo meets giant Treebeard in the forest of Noldorath while seeking for his lost companions. He is deceived by the giant, who pretends to be friendly but is really in league with the enemy." So originally, Treebeard was in league with the enemy.
Wow.
He meets Frodo, which Frodo never meets him.
Right, right? I was going to say. And I thought it was Merry and Pippin.
Lord of the Rings, yeah. Right? And now one thing that's not clear to me, though, okay, and this is something you're going to find in just a second, is this Frodo or is this another Frodo, right? So,
oh, like the Frodo that we know?
Right, or is this another character who eventually winds up under a different name but was named at this point Frodo?
Oh.
Right? So, anyway, I just think it's interesting that Treebeard kind of popped out of nowhere. It was one of these things that popped out of nowhere for Tolkien, maybe earlier on, and then Tolkien eventually figured him back into the story at a later time, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, so that's kind of, you know, that's actually an example of kind of the fun of this Lord of the Rings volume, right? Is you can see where these, you know, different things came from, and you can see the story developing almost like in real time within Tolkien's own mind, right?
Yeah.
So, and you can see something of his creative process. All right. So, that's an overview of the table of contents, a little introduction of how we found Treebeard. So let's look at some of the highlights. So first phase highlights, and this is, I would say, where most of the highlights of the book are, and it's most of the book itself, although there are some in the second and third phases, but let's look at the first phase here. What we get with the first phase can often seem delightfully surreal. It's something like stepping into an alternate reality that is quite different from our own, but similar enough to be recognizable, right?
I like that.
So you think of, like, if you stepped into a world, you know, or you just think of, like, alternate reality kinds of stories where you step into it and it's, like, it's recognizable as our own world, but enough is different to where you're like, that's not our world, right?
I just love the idea of alternate universes.
Right. A little kind of through the looking glass sort of
exactly,
thing.
Exactly.
So that's what reading, especially this first phase, can feel like. It's very familiar. You recognize the patterns, but things are just different enough to be interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so Christopher, here's Christopher's note on the opening. Let's see. Yes, here we go. When he first put pen to paper, he wrote in large letters, "When M," but he stopped before completing the final stroke of the M and wrote instead, "When Bilbo." The text begins in a handsome script, but the writing becomes progressively faster and deteriorates at the end into a rapid scrawl, not at all points legible. There are a good many alterations to the manuscript. So I just find it fascinating that he began this thing. And it was like, "When M," and then he's like, "No, when Bilbo." And it's like, man, who was M?
And I was trying to think, are there any characters whose names? Oh, Mary. But
well, and it's just funny to think, like, you know, was it like a momentary thing where he's like, "When M," and he was like, "No, when Bilbo," or was it like, "When M," and then Edith, like, called to him and was like, you know, "Honey, I need you to come, you know, take out the trash," or something like that, right? And he didn't get back to it for a few minutes or a few hours. And then he's like,
"By
no,
that
it
time,
needs to be Bilbo."
He had changed his mind. That's interesting to ponder how that, what happened there.
And it kind of proceeds like that. I mean, there are moments like that at every turn, right? With this.
Yeah.
But how different could history have been if he had continued with whoever this M character was? Or maybe it was not supposed to be a character, but maybe it was supposed to be a month or something like that. When March rolled around, you know, or something. So.
Right. Yes, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
Or it could have been a place.
Right.
When Moria was underground.
All right. Greta, I want you to read the first paragraph from the original...
Okay. A long-expected party. When Bilbo, son of Bungo of the family of Baggins, had celebrated, or prepared to celebrate, his 70th birthday, there was for a day or two some talk in the neighborhood. He had once had a little fleeting fame among the people of Hobbiton and Bywater. He had disappeared after breakfast one April 30th and not reappeared until lunchtime on June 22nd in the following year, a very odd proceeding for which he had never given any good reason, and of which he wrote a nonsensical account. After that, he returned to normal ways, and the shaken confidence of the district was gradually restored. especially as Bilbo seemed, by some unexplained method, to have become more than comfortably off, if not positively wealthy. Indeed, it was the magnificence of the party, rather than the fleeting fame, that at first caused the talk. After all that other odd business had happened some 20 years before and was becoming decently forgotten. The magnificence of the preparations for the party, I should say. The field to the south of his front door was being covered with pavilions. Invitations were being sent out to all the Bagginses and all the Tooks, his relatives on his mother's side, and to the Grubbs, only remotely connected, and to the Burrowises, the Boffinses, the Chubbses, and the Proudfeet, none of whom were connected at all within the memory of the local historians. Some of them lived on the other side of the shire, but they were all, of course, hobbits. Even the Sackville Bagginses, his cousins on his father's side, were not forgotten. There had been a feud between them and Mr. Bilbo Baggins, as some of you may remember, but so splendid was the invitation card, all written in gold, that they were induced to accept. Besides, their cousin had been specializing in good food for a long time, and his tables had a high reputation even in that time and country, when food was still what it ought to be, and abundant enough for all folk to practice on.
Yeah, so, I mean, it starts off and it's pretty recognizable, yeah. Right, as mm-hmm. as what we eventually get. But I would say, like, with the birthday scene, you know, and kind of the birthday arc through it at the beginning, it remains fairly similar. In fact, it was not, I don't think this was in the original, but, you know, we all know and love Bilbo's, calculus about liking people, right? That's kind of a favorite early line, right? Mm-hmm. And although it's not in the first version, it's contained in the second version, right? So, and he's not, you know, the second version of this first chapter, right? So he pretty quickly got to a lot of the things that, and I think maybe this is attributable to that he still had The Hobbit in kind of that style in his system, right? From having written it before, he knew what people liked, why people liked The Hobbits. And so he was doing a little bit more of that, right? The ring also comes into play in that second version, right? So not to the second phase, but just to the second version. So again, very early on. Mm. But it's not entirely clear that he knew what he was going to do with the ring, right? Mm. So, yeah, we have right here, tremendous outburst of approval. I don't know half of you as well as I would like and less than half of you as well as you deserve, right? And then he steps down. He says goodbye. He stepped down. 144 flabbergasted hobbits sat back speechless. Mr. Proudfoot removed his feet from the table. Mrs. Proudfoot swallowed a large chocolate and choked. And then there was complete silence for quite 40 winks until suddenly every Baggins took Brandybuck, Chub, Grub, Burrows, Bracegirdle, Boffin, and Proudfoot began to talk at once. I don't think he actually disappears from sight right away, but it does mention that he had been fingering a small ring in his trouser pocket. So not too different from the outset here, mm-hmm. right? You know, we have this story beginning with Bilbo. But from here we start to see some, you know, pretty interesting differences. One of them is Frodo's name, as I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. By the third version, Bilbo is married and Frodo is his son.
Oh.
All right. So not his nephew, but Bilbo is married and Frodo is his son. Except Frodo isn't actually Frodo. Frodo is Bingo. So the original name of Frodo, was originally Bilbo's son, and the original name of Frodo was Bingo.
Was Tolkien not familiar with the song? B-I-N-G-O?
Or
Bingo
with the game?
His name-o, right?
I don't know.
Seems like an odd choice for a hobbit name.
Well, and yeah, I agree. So this is one of those things where it's like, I'm pretty thankful that he decided to change that one up.
Same.
I can't imagine that he would have wanted that to be the name of one of the main characters in this story if it was somehow associated with, you know, something else that was super well known like that, right? Mm. But maybe, I don't know, maybe, it, you know, we don't necessarily have him here to ask the thought process on that. And I don't know that Christopher comments on that either, too much, like, you know, as far as like, he was not aware of the, you know, the game called Bingo or something like that. And Frodo at first is Frodo Took, who becomes Drogo, right?
So wait, first he's Bingo.
Well, no. So the character we now know as Frodo was originally Bingo and was Bilbo's son. There is another character that's named Frodo at this point.
Oh, but it's not the Frodo.
But
that
it's
we
not
know.
The Frodo that we know, got right? It. And he was okay. A Took, so he was Frodo mm-hmm. Took, who but he becomes Drogo, right? Later
in the book,
right?
That we know,
and well, later, like, but not in the final version, mm-hmm. right? So there was a lot of changing around of names early on, and then Frodo Took. I'm sorry, Frodo becomes Frodo Brandybuck, who becomes Marmaduke.
Right. Marmaduke Brandybuck.
Marmaduke Brandybuck.
Isn't Marmaduke the name of a dog too? Well,
yeah, it's a it was like a little one of, it was like the square cart, it was one of the like single panel cartoons that's that was in the right. newspaper when I was growing up. It's probably still out there, but Marmaduke, yeah, so
wow, that's funny.
I mean, some, it's just how Tolkien like to just, you know, just struggle over all these different names and being like, no, Frodo's just not right. Frodo is more of a Brandybuck name, and if he's gonna be a Brandybuck, he should be Marmaduke, right? So,
oh, maybe that's what the M was. When M, maybe it was when Marmaduke.
Oh, maybe it was supposed to be Marmaduke.
Maybe Marmaduke.
Goodness gracious.
Oh man.
Maybe Marmaduke was going to be Bilbo's dog.
Oh. Maybe.
And then he was like, well, I can't do that because there's already the Marmaduke dog in the comic strip.
Because that would have been around? Would
I don't know. I'm just being silly.
I don't know if it was even being published in the UK at that point. Even yeah. if it was. But anyway, yeah, it's funny to think about like how different this, you know, all the stages of development
right.
that what we now know as Lord of the Rings has gone through.
Just FYI for those of you who you know, may be expecting, or you know, in the future you want to give your kids interesting names. I feel like Marmaduke needs to make a comeback as a child's name.
No, he's kidding.
It'd be bold. It would be a bold choice. Don't get me wrong, but you know, it's like
Marmaduke.
Just be a trendsetter, you know.
I'm not feeling it, but yeah, maybe someone out there will.
Marmaduke.
Yeah. It's definitely fun to say.
It is a fun name to say,
yeah,
for sure.
Mm-hmm.
The name developments are confusing, but also a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. They're significantly more fun than the Elvish name developments, in my opinion. So
maybe because we can actually pronounce them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and they just added their names like Bingo and Drogo and Frodo and
Marmaduke.
Yeah. All right. Eventually, we also meet Trotter, which is the early name for Strider. Yeah, so Strider was originally named Trotter. I just have to say, I'm glad Tolkien didn't settle on that initial name choice either. I'm very glad on that one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Bingo, Marmaduke, Trotter, they just don't have the same feel as Frodo, Merry, and Strider, right?
If he wanted this to be a story about animals, I think if the main characters were animals, then this could work.
Right.
You know, if he wanted to do his own version of, like, Watership Down...
Mm-hmm.
Those names could work.
Well, and you notice, I feel like the names is maybe originally conceived were a little more cutesy, right? Kind of like some of the names in The Hobbit, and maybe in that style, right? With how it opens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think of some of the dwarf names, which seem a little cutesy, right? Not all of them, but some of them do.
Yes. Yeah.
So, but that's just, I mean, that's my analysis. And I mean, I defer to Tolkien on naming these things because he, you know, he was the linguist and probably knew the history of all of these names. And, you know, they had some noble lineage for all of them. But anyway, Strider, much preferred to Trotter, in my opinion.
Agreed.
Some of the most interesting excerpts are in chapter 13 of this first phase, Queries and Alterations. In that chapter, we get Tolkien's own notes on his story and how he came to make certain early and important changes. For example, we get this on the Bingo Frodo name development. So, yeah, should have had it marked. All right.
Yep.
Too many hobbits, and this is Tolkien's kind of note on his own manuscript. Also, Bingo Bolger Baggins, a bad name. Let Bingo equal Frodo, a son of Primula Brandybuck, but of Father Drogo Baggins, Bilbo's first cousin. So Frodo equals Bingo is Bilbo's first cousin once removed, both on Took's side and on Baggins. Also, he has as proper name Baggins, Frodo, and then he struck Frodo out. No, I am now too used to Bingo. So he was already on it, like, maybe Bingo isn't the right name, and then he's like, Frodo. He's like, yeah, Frodo, and this is the connection. He's like, no, Frodo. Oh, what a horrible name. Frodo's a horrible name. Frodo, i.e. Frodo Took, and Odo are in the know and see Bingo off at gate after the party. Would it not be well to cancel sail and have Odo as heir and in charge? Though many things could be given away. The Sackville Bagginses could quarrel with Odo. Frodo, and possibly Odo, go on the first stage of road because Frodo's news about Black Riders is necessary. But Frodo says goodbye at Buckleberry. Only Merry and Bingo ride on into exile, because Merry insists. Bingo originally intended to go alone. Probably best would be to have only Frodo Took, who sees Bingo to Buckleberry, and then Merry. Cut out Odo. Even better to have Frodo and Merry at the gate. Frodo says goodbye then and is left in charge of the Shire, in the Shire at Bag End. Merry sees Black Riders in the north. So
he had Merry from the beginning.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But let me continue just a little bit. All of this from No, I Am Now Too Used to Bingo was struck out in pencil. And at the same time, my father wrote Sam Gamgee in the margin, and to Bingo, originally intended to go alone, he added with Sam. It may be that this is where he first set down Sam Gamgee's name. So
that's interesting.
Yeah. So we usually get Sam there, but interestingly, although he was on to changing Bingo to Frodo, he wasn't quite ready for that yet. So even this kind of late, I mean, it's still pretty early in the grand scheme of things, but it's late in the game of writing this first part, you know?
So was the character originally named Frodo named Pippin in the original?
I think that's right. Although I haven't made all those connections, going through it myself, but I believe that's correct.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that he had the name Frodo in the beginning. It just wasn't the name, the main character.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I would say there's other very interesting notes about Tolkien kind of thinking through his choices in this chapter 13 of the Queries and Alterations. So he's kind of talking to himself, making notes on his own manuscript for future reference. So that's kind of a little overview of the first phase. The second and third phases proceed in similar fashion, depicting the further development of the early chapters. Not every section is updated, but we can trace certain developments in them. It's not until late 1938, with the beginning of the third phase, aka Tolkien's third iteration of the opening chapters, that Bingo finally becomes Frodo, right?
So it was really late.
And you know, it took him almost a year to change Bingo into Frodo, right?
He just didn't feel right.
Well, and another interesting thing to note is that he kind of very early on went back and forth on whether this was Bilbo's journey or another journey for Bilbo, or this was for a new generation of hobbits, right? The third phase also introduces the opening essay concerning hobbits, right? Which we know from The Lord of the Rings. So it wasn't until the third phase that he was like, maybe I should give some more background on hobbits, right? Very Tolkienian move. But it's the third phase's last chapter, New Uncertainties and New Projections, that features some fascinating insights that Tolkien's thought at this point. For example, he again considered starting afresh, but this time with Bilbo as the story's main protagonist. In truth, Tolkien was still struggling with the core narrative at this point. Read a little snippet from this. New plot. Bilbo is the hero all through. Merry and Frodo, his companions. This helps with Gollum, though Gollum probably gets new ring in Mordor. Or Bilbo just takes a holiday and never returns, and the surprise party, i.e. the party that ended in a surprise, is Frodo's. In which case, Gandalf is not present to let off fireworks. Christopher says, the astonishing suggestion in the first part of this note ignores the problem of lived happily ever after, which had bulked so large earlier. For a brief while, at any rate, my father was prepared to envisage the demolition of the entire Bilbo Frodo structure, the now established and essential idea that Bilbo vanished with a bang and a flash at the end of his 111th birthday party, and that Frodo followed him out of the Shire more discreetly 17 years later. Happily, he did not spend long on this, though he did go so far as to begin a new text headed New Version with Bilbo as Hero, August 1939.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask real quick. So that first thing that Christopher says in the note is that it ignores the problem of lived happily ever after.
Yeah, and I think that's a reference back to earlier in this particular book.
Okay,
but
I was going to say that's not how The Hobbit ends, is it? Or is it? Or maybe it's how the... I can't remember. I guess I was just wondering what that was... that a problem and what is it referring to?
I'm not entirely sure. I don't know that it behooves us to get too into that right now. I mean, one could argue that the original ending of The Hobbit is kind of a lived happily ever after ending.
It is.
Those words may appear, or something like them may appear in there.
Meaning that Bilbo's adventures have come to a close.
Right.
So it would have been hard. It would have not really made a lot of sense for him to have him going off on more adventures in The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Okay.
Right. But it's interesting that then this is in August of 1939, right?
Mm.
That Tolkien almost restarts the whole thing as Bilbo's next adventure, right? Bilbo is the hero of the story. But he quickly decided not to do that and kind of continued with what he'd already mapped out. You know, he'd really mapped out the first 13 chapters at this point of Lord of the Rings. So
I think it's good that he took the time to kind of think through all this and to try on different things, because then, you know, been no regrets. What he came up with, he was like, yeah, I thought about this, but it wasn't quite right. And I thought about this, but that wasn't quite right. So, you know, like, I feel like it's good.
Well,
he took the time to do all that.
Yeah, I can just say as a songwriter that this is often how I come up with the final versions of my songs, right? Is you start with different lyrical ideas, or, you know, different, you know, even just different structures musically to the song. And I'll come up with just different ideas. And oftentimes things just will proceed down a path and will seem like a complete dead end. So I often wind up with, kind of using different ideas as the core of the song, but then I have to scratch that out and something, and eventually, and by the time you get to the finish, you know, to the finished product, the thing that you're actually happy with, it's often very different from where you started out, mm-hmm. or different directions that it almost went, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
And you wind up with all kinds of lyrics left over that you didn't use. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I love the creative process, and mm-hmm. So it's a lot of fun to be able to see this with Tolkien's own creative process.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's at this point that Tolkien finally begins to make it beyond Rivendell, though not too far just yet, only to Moria. so here's a little flavor of our first foray into Moria from page 442 in my volume here. Their adventures must be made different from a lonely mountain. Tunnels leading in every direction, sloping up and running steeply down, stairs, pits, noise of water and darkness. Gandalf guided mainly by the general sense of direction. They had brought one bundle of torches in case of need, two each. Gandalf won't use them until necessary. Faint spark from his staff. Glamdring does not glow, therefore no goblins near. How far to go? How long will it take? Gandalf reckons at least 2 days, perhaps more. Thought of a night or two in Moria terrifies them. Frodo feels dread growing. Perhaps his adventures with the ring have made him sensitive. While others are keeping up spirits with hopeful talk, he feels the certainty of evil creeping over him, but says nothing. He constantly fancies he hears patter of feet of some creature behind. This is Gollum, as it proves long after. So, yeah.
Cool.
So, yeah. So that is The Return of the Shadow in a nutshell. It's a long volume, so there's a lot more here. I think it would be fascinating to do a deep dive into the first phase of this work and to examine its very early developments. As I said earlier, there's something to the idea of the nascent state of something you love. Who hasn't been fascinated by photographs of their parents and grandparents as children? I'd also liken it to listening to early demos of a favorite album. I collect these for my absolute favorites, such as Radiohead's OK Computer and U2's Octane Baby, which you can see the cover of back there, right behind my head. You know, I've got like early demos for both of those records that I've just found in different places, and for lots of other records I love. And it's so interesting to go back and listen to these things, because you hear glimpses and ideas that you recognize became the later songs, but they're vastly different at that stage, right? Mm. In some cases it starts out kind of well formed. But when you're a fan, when you're an intense fan of something, you often enjoy those kind of things, mm-hmm. right? You know, where mm-hmm. did it come from? Where did it start? Because knowing where it came from, where it started, can tell you more about what it became, what it eventually became.
Yeah.
Right?
So true.
So to hear the early glimmers, oftentimes almost unrecognizable, of songs you know well and stories you know well, can breathe new life into
mm-hmm.
them.
Yeah. And really kind of broaden your understanding of the work as it result, you know, the final product.
Yeah.
It can really make you appreciate it that much more too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's the Return of the Shadow.
Cool.
All right. Well, let's turn our attention to a bit of correspondence. The first note this week is from Bethany E. This is one that Bethany sent us back in February, and I don't think we've read this one yet. I think I had it on the list to read a couple of times, but it's a little longer. I don't want to rush through anything. But Bethany, thanks for sending this note, and sorry it's taking us a little while to get to it, but the subject is Latron Prime. Bethany says, "Hello, John and Greta. I listened to your recent episode where you discussed the correspondence related to Latron Prime and just wanted to say how much I appreciated your stand on the issue of nudity and violence that is rumored to appear in the show. I also respect the view that the movies in this show are significant because they can draw a new audience to Tolkien. I understand this firsthand because the Peter Jackson movies were my first introduction to Tolkien. However, what drew me to Tolkien in the movies was the fact that they were different from anything else I had seen from a movie before, and I think this was due to the fact that the trilogy, through all of its flaws, did stay true to Tolkien and his vision, and this is what captured me. I wanted more after seeing the movies because there was a purity and a sacredness about the story that drew me into this other world. The stories of Middle-earth do demonstrate the realities of life, such as violence and sex, though I would argue in a way that serves the story and not just violence and sex for its own sake. But they also show us what Tolkien referred to in On Fairy Stories as escape and consolation. I 100% agree with Tolkien in that, with Greta. I don't know how that happened.
You're getting me mixed up with Tolkien.
I 100% agree with Greta in that I do not want to sit down and watch a show that contains sex and violence for its own sake under the excuse that it's okay because it's reality. The whole point of Tolkien stories is that they allow us to look past the unpleasantness, the brutality, the injustice, the suffering, and see that there is hope and a greater purpose in the midst of them. To see the world through an eternal perspective and recognize that the things of this world are only a passing thing. The mark of a good story is that it allows us the opportunity to escape our own world, if only for a moment, so that we can find hope and a new perspective on our own reality, and also, I would hope, a sense that we could change some of the unpleasant things about our reality. If the new show makes violence and sex the point of the story, it will not draw people to Tolkien because that is not what Tolkien was about. Tolkien stories are about hope, redemption, about light overcoming darkness, and ultimate consolation, all things which I believe our world is in desperate need of today. I want the show to give us that version of something worth fighting for, as Samwise would say. This is clearly a soapbox of my own, so I'll wrap this up, but I just wanted to share my thoughts because I feel so passionately about Tolkien and his vision and want to do all I can to stop it being ruined. If movie makers and showmakers are adapting the work of another creator, they cannot simply do whatever they want. If they were adapting their own work, sure, they can, but since they are working from another, there must be some guidelines and respect to the original author's intentions, even if they may be different from your own." Mm-hmm. And she says, "Lastly, all the best to you both as you start in the next phase of the podcast journey. I'm super excited to hear we will be diving into the history of Middle Earth. Really looking forward to it. Blessings, Bethany." Great note, Bethany.
Absolutely.
You know, I think we are of a similar mind with Bethany on how we hope it all turns out.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. You know, I think you expressed a lot of what I feel, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, and the reasons that we feel the way we do about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I dreamt about the new show last night.
Oh.
And I've been trying to remember what were the details, you know, to see if like it's some kind of message from the, you know, from the great beyond, to what it's actually going to be, or if it was just my brain being weird as I dreamed. But,
do you remember how you felt about it in your dream? Like, Had you watched it and were reacting to it?
So it's coming back to me. So a little bit's coming back to me. So what I remember is that it was kind of surprise released, but it was surprise released as a new movie.
Oh, not a series.
And it was not about Numenor. It was about Aragorn. And I think there were even hobbits in it, but it was not Lord of the Rings. It was surprise released as a new Lord of the Rings movie, right? And it was about Aragorn. So
this was like fan fiction,
right? And I remember we were on vacation somewhere to where we couldn't like easily record a response episode to it. And I was like panicking because I was like, oh man, we can't do our like quick response, to the new Tolkien, to the new Lord of the Rings movie that came out. This is horrible. So
that's so funny. That must be one of your deep seated fears about something big happening in the world of Tolkien, and we're not able to quickly respond to it.
Yeah, and also it not being like it being some them just doing some kind of thing that they're kind like, we're going to do this like, and whatever. Try to be popular, and it's going to be.
Well, it's definitely one of my big fears. Yeah, that's for sure. You know, we'll just have to see. I'm trying not to think about it, or like really get my expectations too high.
Well, I'm not trying to get my expectations too high, but I'm trying to be optimistic about it. I feel like there's a reasonable chance they're going to do a good job, so I'm hopeful they will. Hope. I'm pulling for them to do a good job, but I'm also going to be really mad if they don't. So,
do we have have they updated like release timeline or anything like that?
Not that no. I've heard of.
So it's going to be next year.
Let me hop onto Twitter here.
Is that right?
Just real time and see if there's anything new.
Well, what is it like last we heard? What was the, what were they thinking?
Let's see here. So, principal photography in mid-July, pickup shots and reshoots of season one until the 5th of August, depending on New Zealand winter weather. Yeah, that's not official. That's from the Fellowship of Fans Twitter account. Let's see. Nothing new from Latron Prime itself. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So nothing official. Nothing official. Hopefully, maybe by the end of the year, we're going to get a little something.
Okay.
All right. Well, Bethany, thanks again for your awesome note. Appreciate it.
Super good. Thank you.
All right. Our next note is a shorter one, and it's from... William J. Greetings from Owensboro, Kentucky. Hello, Carswells. My journey to Tolkien started with the movies coming out when I was a kid, and I have enjoyed all of the films being put out since then. With the new Amazon series coming, I wanted as much background as I could find on Tolkien's world without reading all of his works. My schedule is fairly limited with what I can do as far as reading, so listening to your podcast has been perfect for me during my commute. Awesome.
Yeah.
It has given me all of the info I'm after and is a great listen. I began listening to the pod in January, starting with episode one, and I'm proud to say I've recently caught up to the current episodes of the podcast.
Wow.
That's a lot of
impressive.
Listening. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The podcast has gotten me so interested in Tolkien that I am even more proud to say that after listening to all the Silmarillion episodes, I decided to carve out some time to give it a read and have successfully finished the Silmarillion cover to cover. Loved it
awesome.
All.
Awesome.
Sweet.
Mm-hmm.
The tragedy of Fëanor is by far my favorite part of the book. I feel like he had a lot working against him from the get-go, and the way he was treated wasn't fair to a certain point. I felt sorry for him right up until he decided he needed the Teleri ships more than Teleri did. I will have to give the book another read to pick up on things that I have missed, and I'm excited to do so when I can carve out more time to read. If I'm remembering correctly, in an early episode, John said he grew up on the Ohio River, and I believe he said in Kentucky. Also, like clockwork, every March you guys discuss March Madness and thought, wow, someone who enjoys Tolkien college basketball and is from Kentucky? Awesome. Until episode 90, yes, I remember the episode number, haha, when you were reading the correspondence from a Louisville listener and I heard those terrible words, go Cards. I guess we should be friends in Tolkien and rivals on the basketball court. Hashtag BBN, which I believe is Blue Blood Nation, I think, is that for Kentucky.
Right.
Yeah. Still love the podcast and will continue listening and hopefully begin to support via Patreon. Keep up the great work. Go Big Blue, Alex Johnson.
it's funny.
Yeah. So your email said William, so I guess your name is Alex, but I'll call you Alex since that's what you ended the actual email with. So, Alex, thanks for your note. Mm-hmm. Yes, unfortunately, I root for the Cardinals just a little bit more than the Cats, but I'm not one of these Cardinals fans that that hates the Wildcats, right? Mm. So, it's like for me, it's like if Cardinals are playing, they're always number one. If the University of Kentucky is playing and the Cardinals aren't playing, then I'm pulling for the University of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. My brother, who passed away a few years ago, was a huge UK fan. But I grew up going to U of L home games. My dad had season tickets for a few seasons. So, you know, and they won the national championship when I was like 7 years old. So I was all about, you know, the Cardinals. So hopefully you're not a Cardinal hater, but there's a good chance you are, because I think that rivalry is all about like one team hating the other nowadays. But I grew up when it was maybe a kinder and gentler time. So I had love for both. But go Cards. All right. great hearing from you. And please keep in touch on your journey. Thanks for listening to us so intensely. And I'm glad that you've gave the Silmarillion a try and enjoyed it so much. So our last note is from, it's just a comment on YouTube from this guy. So this guy on episode 238 said, "Longtime listener, first time watcher, great job. I keep getting distracted by the content to write. Thanks so much." I know the feeling. I get distracted by you know, things that I find listen to and find interesting as well. So if it's time to write, then maybe it's best not to be listening to us. But maybe when you're doing something where you're not required to be creative yourself, it might be a good time for you. So not to stop you from listening. Hope you'll continue. And continue watching.
Yeah.
On YouTube.
Yes. So,
subscribe to us on YouTube. Yes.
Yep.
All the other people who aren't. Like this guy probably is. So
funny. I love that he called himself this guy.
Yeah. So some of the names on YouTube are crack me up. So
if only he had included two thumbs in there somehow. Who has two thumbs and just left a review on YouTube?
This guy. All right. Well, that is our correspondence for this week. And that is the episode for this week.
Alrighty, Rudy.
By the way, we'd love to hear from you. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc. On our next episode, we will continue our survey of the history of Middle-earth with Volume 7, The Treason of Isengard, where we will explore the next stage in the development of the Lord of the Rings. All right, thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Lee Sue,
Andrew T,
John R,
Ms. Anonymous,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Azia V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Matt L,
Johanna T,
Sam N,
Mike M,
Duranayer,
Robert H,
Paul D,
Jacob S,
and Julia.
As well as those celebrating their patron anniversary in May: Ms. Anonymous,
Joshua Y,
Donna S,
Rebecca R,
James R,
and Ty M.
Thank you all so much.
Yes, thanks, guys.
Thanks to all of our amazing patrons, and thanks to everyone who is listening. And we will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.